I'm Darren Grimes, Digital Manager at the IEA, and you're about to hear Deirdre McCloskey's talk at the IEA's Think Conference on how ideas can change the world. From 2000 to 2015, McCloskey was the Distinguished Professor of Economics, History, English, and Communication at the University of Illinois in Chicago. McCloskey's Bourgeois Virtues Trilogy, 2006, 2010, and 2016, examines factors in history that led to advancement in human achievement and prosperity. She argues that enrichment comes from innovation rather than capital accumulation, as is often argued. She self-describes as a postmodern, quantitative, literary, ex-Marxist, economist, historian, progressive Episcopalian, coastie-bred woman who was once not. I hope you'll enjoy the talk as much as I did.
And the question is how to approach the economy, how to think about it. Well, I suppose we can go back well over a couple of hundred years to Adam Smith, and that's a good place to go. But Adam Smith wrote another book. He didn't just write a treatise on the nature and causes of the wealth of nations, but earlier he had made his European reputation as a philosopher with his book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which is a great book, which I highly recommend to you. Once you've gotten past the somewhat arch 18th century style, it's funny, hard to believe, but it is, and it's intensely humane. Smith was one of a long series of English, or should we say Scottish, economists who was more than an economist and calculator, as Edmund Burke scornfully referred to our tribe, but was also a humanist, as a man of his generation, educated man of his generation. He was fluent in Latin, of course. He could have given his lectures in Latin, but he in fact gave them in English. And his book of 1759 is one that every economic student ought to read. And that's my theme. My claim is that modern economics should become humanomics. Economics with the humans left in. This is not to say that it should spurn mathematics or statistics or factfulness. On the contrary, what I'm advocating is a supplement to economics of a sort that would have been very natural to John Maynard Keynes, for example, who won the Greek Poetry Prize at Eton when he was a lad, or Alfred Marshall, or John Stuart Mill, the great figures in British economics, until essentially after what we older people call the war, namely the Second World War, were broadly educated in the humanities. They knew history, they knew literature, they could read Greek and Latin. They knew philosophy. Keynes was a substantial, or in a sense began his academic career as a substantial philosopher of probability theory. So I want to bring back that tradition. Now there are portions of economics that still contain it, if only in its essence. Austrian economics, which I've been increasingly attracted to in the last couple of decades, has a lot of similarity to what I'm calling humanomics. But I was trained very conventionally. I was trained, if you call it that, in economics at Harvard at its worst time, when Harvard was not a very good economics department, and I got my BA and my PhD there. Then I served for 12 years as a professor at the famous University of Chicago at its height of its excellence as a creative department of economics, more or less the same time that Cambridge, England and Cambridge, Massachusetts in the form of MIT were also leading departments. They have both fallen on, all three of them actually have fallen on bad times since then. And then I went on to various other university appointments, but in the 80s, I started to drift. There's a joke that the great American comedian Mae West has. She says, "I'm in favor of marriage, the institution of marriage, but I'm not ready for an institution." And she also said, "I was Snow White, but I drifted." So I was a regular economist, mathematical, quantitative, and so forth, and then I drifted. And I want you all to drift along with me. Humanomics, that is economics that's more than economics. Keynes said famously, "An economist is only an economist, can't be much of an economist." Now, the way education, higher education, is structured in Britain, it's going to take some effort for you to broaden yourself as you're studying economics, because you tend here, in fact, it's the United States that's strange, not you. When you read economics at university in this country, that's all you read. Margaret Thatcher, for example, read chemistry. And she did chemistry, and that's all. So what you're going to have to do is to broaden yourself on your own. You're going to have to read novels, read philosophy, read journals of opinion, most particularly the most broad and intellectually Catholic ones, and try to keep yourself from becoming, as our great Ralph Waldo Emerson expressed it, keep yourself from becoming a thinking human as opposed to a human thinking. That is, first be a human, be a broad person, acquainted with your own and other cultures. I was just in China for 3 weeks, and I'm so proud. On that trip, I learned 20 Chinese characters. 20, can you believe it? Now, of course, in order to read a newspaper in China, you need to read 3,000, but, you know, I'm on my way. So make yourself acquainted as you become a specialist. Now, there isn't anything wrong with learning economics, even as presently constituted. I'm not making an argument against everything in modern economics. I am, indeed, the best advice I've ever heard on this score is to dig deeply in economics as a specialty and then read widely as well, so that you know what specialism, what a deep understanding of a science is, and then acquaint yourself with the rest. Now, when I make this argument, and I've been making it in one form or another for about 40 years, since economics hasn't much changed, you can judge from that empirically what my impact on the profession is. But when I make this argument, most of my economic colleagues get kind of irritated, not just kind of irritated, very irritated. And they say, but how does this help us with economic science? Our job as economists is to understand the economy, to characterize modern economic growth, to understand why it's probably not a good idea to run the economy always from the top down. And they want, as a friend of mine, Herbert Gintis, expressed it to me, a killer app of humanomics, a killer app. And here it is. It's embodied in this wonderful book called Bourgeois Equality, and here the subtitle: How Ideas, Not Capital or Institutions, Enrich the World. How ideas enrich the world, not material or institutional accumulations. And it's an argument, there are actually three volumes of this. This is volume three, which is why it's so fat. This book was published in 2016. And here's the 3-minute summary of the three books. What we ordinarily call capitalism is not so bad. It's not instantly corrupting, or at least no more instantly corrupting than socialism or monarchy is. And what made us rich in this so-called capitalism was not the capital, not the accumulation, not the buildings or the human capital that you're engaged in accumulating, but the ideas behind the capital, the ideas that made such an investment worthwhile. This hall was built as a not a profit-making enterprise, but as something that would be worth having in the society. If it was not worth having, we wouldn't be here. It would stand empty. Your intellectual capital, your human capital that you higher and secondary and higher education involves, makes you a little better off, but what makes the whole enterprise of higher education worthwhile is the accumulation of ideas, the idea of the carbon ring, the idea of MV equals PT, the idea of the test of an investment project being how much it earns, whether in private terms or in social terms. Those are ideas that themselves make the rest profitable. Here's another way of saying it. Capital and institutions, that is, capital accumulation and institutions, are necessary for modern economic growth, but nothing like sufficient. The thousands of ideas embodied in your minds and in physical capital, accumulated ideas now, since 1800 or so, those are what made us rich. That we have cell phones, that we have electricity, that we have central heating, although my experience in Britain is that that's inadequate. That we have what we have comes from our minds The hands are necessary. The making of the capital, the educating of the people is necessary, but it's not sufficient. The ideas are sufficient because they make the accumulation profitable. Now, I was taught as a Harvard undergraduate to be a Keynesian, and I was a Keynesian. I was a socialist, for that matter. And I thought, along with my teachers, told me this, that if you pour investment into an economy, you make it rich. And that was the basis of foreign aid for a long time. We would give masses of capital to Ghana and not a cent to what we call Red China, and expected Ghana to do very well and Red China to do very poorly. And of course, that's not what happened. So it turned out that what Bill Easterly calls capital fundamentalism, that is, just get the capital, just pile up stuff, and then you'll have multiplier effects, and oh, we'll all get rich that way, turns out to be a lousy idea. What we need is a society that encourages ideas. Exactly as my introducer was saying, universities, above all, should be places where new ideas are tried out, not suppressed. Now, so what? What does this all mean? Why, you haven't told me yet, you'll say, what this, what's it called? What this killer app is. It's this. The reason we're rich is that we had a lot of technical and institutional ideas from 1800 on in vast numbers that get bigger and bigger. My friend Matt Ridley talks about ideas having sex, and that's about right. The ideas, the mama and daddy ideas, have get together, and that makes for children ideas, and they have sex, and it expands. Why? Why did this happen uniquely in Northwestern Europe from the 18th century on? Why not in China or Japan or Northern India or the Ottoman Empire, all of which could have had an industrial revolution or, what's more important, a great enrichment? How large a great enrichment? You have to understand this. 3,000%. You are richer than your ancestors in 1800, in real terms, not by 100% or 200%, but by 3,000%. Why? Why this outburst of human creativity after 1800? My answer is liberalism, in a word. A uniquely Dutch and British idea of the 18th century, French to some degree, which said that the best way of organizing society is not to organize it, to allow ordinary people to do what they want. No guilds preventing you from entering an occupation. Guilds which, by the way, are reviving in the modern world. In my own country, in 1950, 5% of occupations required state licenses. Now it's 30%, shocking figure. So it turned out that letting people free was what made us rich, that it was liberalism, the notion that a society of free people, women free from their husbands, children free from their parents, slaves free from their masters, citizens free from their governments. It turned out, rather unsurprisingly when you think it through, that inspirited ordinary people. I give hundreds of examples in the book. It inspirited people. They said, oh yeah, I can have a go. I'm permitted to have a go. The society, if I'm born as a milkmaid, I don't need to stay one forever. That liberal idea is what made for the ideas of innovation on a massive scale. And the other explanations, if you want to hear about them, they're in these marvelous books, cheap on Amazon, don't work. They're too small. They don't have scientific oomph. So the killer app is that liberty explains modern economic growth, and nothing else does. One concluding analogy. The old mechanical watches that your great-grandfather carried around, mechanical indeed, with gears, and the gears and the clock, the watch face and so on are essential. They're necessary. But without a spring, the watch just sits there. Without the spring of liberty, a society that has excellent institutions and good capital markets, and rule of law and peace and so forth, will not develop the way ours has, and the way now the entire world is. India and China in particular have seen this and have let the spring of economic freedom, at least, operate. So that's a case of humanomics, bringing to bear what we know beyond the unnecessarily narrow confines of conventional economics. Thank you.
After her think talk, I managed to catch up with Deirdre to ask a few more questions. As I'm sure you can imagine, I could have went on all day. Here we go. Thank you very much, Deirdre, for joining me today and for being with us at the IEA. I listened to you at Think on Saturday and you were truly incredible.
Well, thank you.
Everyone left feeling really enthused, which is exactly the name of the game, the
well,
aim
good.
Of the game.
I hope so.
Now, I wonder if to start you can talk about, in your transformative bourgeois era trilogy, you challenge popular theories about the causes of our economic prosperity in the West, arguing that it sprung, well, actually not just limited to the West, arguing that it sprung from not from new systems, tools or materials, but rather the ideas, virtues and even the rhetoric behind them. Could you explain a little bit about how
it certainly is the improved tools and the ideas for new organizations and other sort of obvious pieces of innovation, which have been extraordinary in the last couple of centuries, that have increased national income, it's those innovations, by a factor of 30, almost 3,000%. Now, these are rough figures, of course, but it's that order of magnitude. So our ancestors in Britain or the United States Japan or Finland were bumping along on $2 or $3 a day. Imagine trying to live on that in London. To now $100.
You can't even buy a pint for
you can't,
three.
Can't buy a pint. You can buy half a cappuccino. So it's been an extraordinary change. So why? Was it capital accumulation? I argue, no. Was it trade? No. Was it improvement of allocation, better legal rules, as Douglas North claimed? No. What it was the loosening of constraints on people that we call liberalism. It's that made people bold. And I've got a good deal. This isn't just some sort of crazy hypothesis. I've got a good deal of evidence for it. And being bold, they became terribly, terribly inventive. What's most surprising indeed about the 19th century is how various ordinary people, not a bunch of toffs, but ordinary people invented stuff. So it was an extraordinary achievement of this ideological, rhetorical, ethical change. Mm-hmm.
I wonder what you mean by rhetoric, the rhetoric around it, because I think in modern day politics, when you think of flowery rhetoric, you think of politicians with sound bites that don't mean
anything. Bloviation, we call it.
Well, quite, yeah. So I wonder, what do you mean? What was it about the rhetoric of that era that you think inspired people?
It's how we talk about each other. So it's the habits of the lip, you might say. And Jane Austen, to take my favorite author, was not hostile to the bourgeoisie. She wasn't herself urban middle class. She had a brother who became a banker in London. But she was not scornful the way, say, Shakespeare was. Shakespeare himself bourgeois by any definition, yet had none of his heroes mm-hmm. being middle class. Mm-hmm. And Antonio was a fool for love. Shylock is hardly an admired figure. Yes. So there was a big change in the 18th century. You can see it in lots of people. Samuel Johnson used to say, nobody but a blockhead wrote for anything but money. And he had a friend who said, when you think about it, the most innocent employment a person can have is making something for someone else. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I took down this quote from Think Conference on Saturday when you said that your argument was, what is responsible for human creative activity since 1800, mm-hmm. that the source of our prosperity? Liberalism, in a word.
Yep, in a word.
A uniquely Dutch, British, and French to some extent?
To some extent. Well, the French were the theoreticians.
Yeah.
But they had, since the 16th century, the statism, Colbert and all that.
Dirigiste.
Yeah. And they still do it. Henry Kissinger is fond of calling France the only successful communist country.
So you also argue the reason for that is that liberalism, a liberal society economy, is the best way to organize.
Yes.
I guess because it doesn't organize people?
It doesn't organize them in a top-down way.
Yeah.
But as Hayek said, there is such a thing as spontaneous order. And the best example of it is what we're doing right now, language. Mm. There's no central office in Whitehall that's telling us not to split infinitives or something. Mm. And if we want to boldly split infinitives, we do it. Mm-hmm. And then that becomes the standard language, and the language evolves. And it's amazing spontaneous order, which makes it puzzling to me why people don't see the economy in the same way. Mm. They think the economy should be run from the center or heavily regulated. They're, you know, the first thing on a journalist's from a journalist's lips when something goes wrong in his view in the economy is, where were the regulators?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's like saying when someone splits an infinitive, where were the regulators to stop that terrible person? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you for listening to this podcast with Deirdre McCloskey and me, Darren Grimes. Let us know what you think by tweeting at IEA London. And you can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts and find more films, blogs, podcasts, and reports at iea.org.uk.